I'd like to convene this meeting of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. Good morning. It is Wednesday, November 30th, 2016. All three commissioners are present, and that constitutes a quorum. Our first item of business is a proclamation of World AIDS Day in Lincoln County, and our presenter is ready.
You're ready.
Come forward. Okay. I will read the proclamation as they get settled in. Whereas World AIDS Day is held on December 1st each year and is an opportunity for people worldwide to unite in the fight against HIV, to show their support for people living with HIV, and to commemorate people who have died, World AIDS Day was the first ever Global Health Day, held for the first time in 1988. And whereas globally, over 39 million people have died of HIV/AIDS, and 1.9 million people were newly infected each year of the last 5 years, and in some regions is increasing. And whereas HIV/AIDS is a top health concern in the United States, with an estimated 50,000 new HIV infections still occurring each year, 1.2 million Americans living with HIV, nearly 648,500 deaths since 1981. And whereas HIV/AIDS remains an important public health problem in Oregon, from 1981 through 2014, 9,692 HIV infections were diagnosed in Oregon residents. Approximately 42% of them have died. From 2010 to 2014, approximately 240 new diagnoses were reported annually in Oregon. And whereas worldwide strides are being made to reduce the incidence of HIV/AIDS, since 2000, 30 million new infections were prevented, nearly 8 million deaths averted, and 15 million people living with HIV are now receiving treatment. The efforts to prevent HIV/AIDS, however, are stalling, and whereas in recognition of the fact that impacting this global epidemic requires renewed and unified worldwide, national, and local efforts, the World AIDS Campaign theme for World AIDS Day 2016 is Access Equity Rights Now. The aim is that every person, regardless of age, gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, or socioeconomic circumstance, will have unfettered access to high-quality, life-extending care, free from stigma and discrimination. We want to assure equal access to health care, HIV/AIDS treatment, and renewed efforts to prevent this disease. Now, therefore, we, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, recognize World AIDS Day, observed on December 1st, 2016, and encourage all citizens to understand the importance of the activities and observances that occur during this week, designed to increase awareness and understanding of HIV/AIDS as a global challenge, to prevent the further spread of the disease, to take part in HIV/AIDS prevention activities and programs, and to promote sustained action to reduce new HIV infections and to assure life-saving treatment for everyone living with HIV and AIDS. Good morning, everybody. Welcome, and please introduce yourselves.
I'm Jeannie St. John, and today I'm representing both the Community College, OCCC, and PFLAG.
I'm Nicole Fields. I'm the Health Promotion Program Manager for Public Health.
I'm Sam Schaefer. I'm a Health Education Specialist for Public Health.
Stacey Science, Public Health Nurse for Lincoln County.
Okay. Take it away.
Jeannie, would you like to talk about some of the things that are going on at the college?
Sure. It's a busy week out there. PFLAG worked with the community college to arrange a display of two panels of the AIDS quilt. And I don't know if you have ever seen any of those panels. We've had displays of them every few years in different parts of the county. If you can get out there by Friday, it's in the library, and the panels are big. The panels are 12 feet by 12 feet. So it takes pretty good wall space to display those. And we ask for panels that were specific to Oregon and Lincoln County where possible. So most of the names and the stories, the individual people's stories are told in their panel, their little piece of it. And it's just fascinating and heartbreaking to see photos of these young, vital men and to see what their interests were. Some of them were into motorbikes and cars, and others were artists and poets. But a little piece of their story is in their panels. So if it's impressive to see it in person. The whole quilt now is so huge that it weighs 54 tons. And it's in a warehouse in Atlanta. And they are able to pull out pieces, they're all numbered, so if people request different panels of it, they can get two different ones. There are 48,000 panels, and each of them has like 6 to 8 stories, different people on it. So it's like 94,000, I think, people, stories are contained on this quilt. It's just, it's a wonderful image and metaphor for how we are all connected.
I heard an interview on NPR's Fresh Air just yesterday with the gentleman who came up with the idea for the quilt. You know, he mentioned that the last time it was publicly displayed, I believe, was in the mid-1990s on the Washington Mall, and at that time it stretched all the way from the Capitol building to the Washington Monument.
Wow. Yeah. Huge. Yeah. Huge and beautiful and sad.
Yes.
But it humanizes what happened and what continues to happen. And the college has become a real partner with PFLAG and the LGBT community in working on their policies were fine. That was all good. But we're looking for ways to make it more openly friendly. A rainbow corner in the library where books relative to those issues are easily available and identifiable. PFLAG worked with them on making sure that there were gender-neutral bathrooms throughout the buildings. And that was not a problem. Fortunately, those buildings are recent, and there were single stall bathrooms that were easy to just... I mean, I don't understand why all single stall bathrooms are not labeled restroom. You know, what's the big deal? Just like, anybody can use it. Anyway, the college has been real good with working with us on that. And having an LGBT representative on their council. So it feels very inclusive and very supportive of what we're doing in the community. And having the display there this week, and then on Thursday, we're having a candlelight AIDS ceremony at 6:30 at the college, outdoors if it's not pouring, in the commons if it's wet. And so that's in observance of International AIDS Day. And then the next day, PFLAG is sponsoring its annual GSA, Gay Straight Alliance, we have a conference every year for those kids throughout the county. And last year there were 50-some kids who attended. And it was wonderful for them to meet each other from different schools, and they shared what their successes had been and the stuff they had tried. And then we had a guest from Portland who works with GSAs all over the state. So it was a mini conference. It was only about 3 hours, and there was lots of refreshments and pizza involved. That's what we're doing this Friday, is that annual GSA conference. So it's feel like a lot of collaboration is going on, and good things for especially young people.
Excellent.
Thank you. And then do you two have some information
sure.
you'd like to share?
So Nicole, Stacy, and I... Is that better?
Thank you.
So Nicole, Stacy, and I are really here to represent public health and Health and Human Services as a whole, and we first want to thank you for making this proclamation today. We do have some information. I have some handouts for you guys on basic HIV trends in Oregon, as well as a word cloud for HIV prevention. You don't have to read this material now, but just note that in Oregon we have seen an uptick of HIV cases, as well as here in Lincoln County, and so today is really important for more than one reason, and we so greatly appreciate your support for HIV prevention and support for those living at high risk, as well as living with HIV and AIDS, so thanks so much for that. I do want to point out, if you look at the HIV prevention word cloud, there are two acronyms on here, and I just wanted to explain those. We have PrEP, which looks like it's on like the pinky finger or thumb, sorry, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis for individuals. It's a preventative measure. It's a pill that can be taken to prevent HIV infection for those at high risk. And then we also, at the bottom of the hand, have VMMC, which is voluntary medical male circumcision. So those are two very important pieces to the HIV prevention pie. So,
do you have anything to add?
Sure. I just wanted to say, as of October 1st, in Lincoln County specifically, we have 51 people living with HIV and AIDS. And they're at this point, they're all over 30 years old. Now, that's not true in the state. The state has children with living with it as well, but we have lots of things in the works about getting the word out. We have free HIV testing at the public health department for people who don't have insurance, so just trying to get people's awareness back up. I think we kind of went into a lull about HIV and got a little blasé about it, so
yeah, that's been my impression. You know, it was such a big headline through the 80s and even into the 90s. And then I guess with the coming of the cocktail, it was no longer necessarily an automatic death sentence. And yet this is still a very serious disease, as the numbers show. It's infecting and it's still killing a lot of people. And so anything we can do to support your efforts, all of your efforts, appreciate the opportunity to draw the spotlight here today and anything else we can do.
Thank you
for the good work. Comments or questions from my colleagues?
Well, I'd be interested, talk about the global situation in some regions it's increasing. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening worldwide and maybe some of the differences as to why they're not, what the factors might be as far as affecting that rate of infection?
Well, worldwide, the biggest factor is socioeconomic issues worldwide.
When you're poverty.
Poverty, mm-hmm. is the number one. Lack of education, lack of resources. We have a basket of free condoms sitting at the health department front desk. You know, most folks in the world don't have that access. So lots of different factors, but the usual socioeconomic are the main ones.
So if somebody in the county felt that they might be infected, I think you indicated they could go to the public health department. But could you talk a little bit more about what options are available and what services the county provides?
So obviously, like I said, we offer free testing, and then if someone is HIV positive, actually we've had two in the last couple of months, two brand new HIV cases, which was unusual. All of last year we had one, and the year before we had none. Once folks are diagnosed HIV positive, we sit them down and we go through our public health interview and find out who their contacts are so we can offer them testing and treatment. But then we get them hooked up with HIV Alliance in our region, and they're a remarkable group, a nonprofit group that sets them up with an infectious disease doctor, housing if they need it, dental. I mean, they're just amazing. And they walk them through the process, help them get funds to pay for these meds, which are very expensive. So they're just a great resource. So
it's great service.
Commissioner Thompson.
So I'm either not aware or inaccurate information. I'm pulling some of your numbers out of the back of your sheet. Injected drugs. I was under the impression that, and it's certainly an impression, lack of knowledge probably, but that the injected drug users I thought was a lot higher than the percentage that you're given here. And I'm not sure I understand exactly what you, but men looks like it could be as high as 15%, and correct me if I'm wrong, and women it's 22%. And I was always under the impression that a lot higher percentage of HIV was caused or was handled through injected drugs. So would you comment on that?
We didn't have my little PowerPoint. We just went to an HIV seminar for the state. Actually, the IV drug use is a significant portion, but the males having sex with males is still the predominant group that is infected with HIV and AIDS. So it is, in our county alone, 76% of those living with HIV and AIDS are in that category. And the injection drug use is only 11% for males, but 46% for females. But that's there's only 13 females in Lincoln County with HIV AIDS. So of those, in females, the number is higher, the percentage is higher.
Yeah, that was the number I picked out here, that females was so much higher.
Right.
So
right.
Is there an explanation for that?
I think that if you want to bring up what you were talking about when we were back there too, the education piece.
Right. So when folks are using drugs or alcohol, actually increases your risk of STDs in general, but poor judgment is being used. And so women do not realize that having anal sex is actually increases their risk for HIV and AIDS more than anything else. So they think they're being safe, and they're not. So it's hard to tell on those numbers if, honestly, patients are not always forthcoming about their sexual practices. So they would much rather tell me that they, yes, I used IV drugs than details about their sexual habits. So
that's it. That's explains the numbers, because I was looking at the statewide numbers. You're looking at the local numbers.
And right.
They're not exactly the same, but they're showing that. And so it's any of those kinds of unusual activities increases your rate dramatically.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, I think there's obviously a stigma attached to people that are infected, and I think part of the educational process is the fact that HIV AIDS is transmitted sexually. It's not transmitted through coughing or sneezing.
That's right.
Could you maybe share some of that information so we do educate listeners or viewers as to the fact that that stigma really isn't founded on science?
Right. So I think, really when it comes down to it, talking about all the different ways that HIV can be transmitted, like Commissioner Thompson is saying, you know, a lot of people think that it's primarily IV drug users, when you can get an accidental stick on your finger, and if there is blood on that, then you could potentially be infected. There are also many ways sexually, as you're talking about, Commissioner Hunt, that you can be infected, among other, you know, blood transfusions. So it's not always, you have to be a really risky individual to become HIV positive. I'm not sure if you've been on.
Well, they did say at the conference, you know, it's proven that semen actually has more of a viral load than blood, to get right down to it, to be blunt. So sexually transmitted is the number one way. But again, a lot of folks don't think about different ways, sexual behaviors. Oh, I'm doing it this way so I'm safer. No, absolutely not. Any way with unprotected sex without a condom puts you at risk, some greater than others. So, yeah.
But really, sexual activities and or blood contact in some sort would be the primary.
Sex and blood.
That's what I was trying to clarify.
And breast milk.
Condoms
and breast milk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but not saliva.
All right. Well, again, I think that's good information.
Well, and I think, it, you know, the public health promotion part of it is to simplify and teach this stuff as broadly and openly as possible, because most people don't know that. And, you know, for gosh sakes, it's a virus. You know, it's a virus. This virus is transmitted most easily these ways, and here's what you can do to protect yourself from this virus.
And helping people become comfortable talking to their partners about making sure that safe sex is a priority for them, and that knowing what their options are for getting tested, getting free condoms if they need them.
Yes.
Right.
All right. Thank you for some important information. Are we ready for a motion?
I'll move for approval of the resolution proclaiming World's AIDS Day on December 1st, which is tomorrow, 2016, in Lincoln County.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And if you can be tomorrow for the candlelight vigil at the community college, it would be great to see you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I'll be coming back
from Albany, but if I make it in time, I will come.
And I'll be an escort.
We're on the road a lot. But yeah. Okay, thanks, everybody. Next up, the consent calendar. Routine items or items that have been discussed at previous meetings. Anything that staff or commissioners wish to highlight or exclude?
I'll make a motion to adopt the consent calendar.
I'll second it.
Moved and seconded to approve the consent calendar. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
It's approved. Next up, we move to decision and action items, and the first thing is assignment of Lincoln County Ambulance Service Area, ASA 4, Walport area, for the period of January 1st, 2017 through June 30th of 2021. Sheriff Landers.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
How are you?
Okay, how are you?
Commissioners, if I might, Assistant Counsel Yule was going to be doing part of this presentation, but she's actually doing some instruction this morning. She's teaching some classes, so I'll do a quick run through and then turn over to the sheriff to answer any questions you might have. So as you may recall, the county is responsible for assigning ambulance service areas in accordance with the county code, the Lincoln County Ambulance Service Plan, and some state laws and administrative rules. And we went through a process of actually putting out four solicited proposals for four of the five ASAs previously, and you made awards for a five-year period and not too long ago. Ambulance Service Area 4, originally the services were provided by Central Coast Fire and Rescue. They actually did the direct ambulance services, but towards the end of their last ASA assignment period, they basically had some difficulties financially in keeping that service going, so they ended up contracting for the last few months with Pacific Coast Ambulance to continue on those services. And at that point, there was some discussion about possible alternatives that could come forward to provide services. So we extended the ASA time frame and period 4 to December 31st of 2016 to to allow for some things to occur and then allow for another process to go forward just for that ASA and have proposals come forward. Well, subsequent to that time, a variety of things have occurred down there. I think you're pretty familiar with what happened. But in the process of soliciting proposals, we ended up only getting a single proposal. There was not alternatives that were developed or brought forward. So we have a single proposal in front of us right now. That came from PacWest Ambulance, who is, of course, the service provider now currently for ASAs 1, 2, and 3. So this would be adding another one to them. That proposal has been reviewed by the sheriff in his emergency services capacity and then by our office and found to meet all the requirements of the county code, the ambulance service plan, and the administrative rules. So the recommendation is to award this ASA to Pacific West Ambulance. Now, what we would do is try and bring this back in line with the other ASAs. So rather than a five-year award, we're recommending it be a four-year award. So
Four and a half years.
So that would run through, I guess, at June 30th of 2021. Is that correct?
2022, I believe. 2021, okay.
So it does bring it. It's a little bit different time frame. That they're having it's a 4.5 year period rather than a 5 year period, which the others got.
Just to line them with the rest of the ASAs in the county.
The same cycle.
Yes. I may add that Pacific West, when they turned in their proposal, basically just added ASA number 4 to their original proposal when they submitted for ASAs 1, 2, and 3 that were approved in July. So they basically just added it. When I reviewed it, I didn't see anything different except for that addition of ASA number 4.
Okay, that was going to be my question. Questions?
I have a couple of questions. I assume, but I'll ask, that the services being provided by Pacific West are satisfactory, meaning a contract?
Yes, they are. The Ambulance Service Review Committee that's been meeting reviews all complaints, and there have not been any complaints related to ASA number 4 since they took over in June.
Okay. I guess that would be my second question. And how is the advisory committee, review committee functioning now?
It's coming along. It's improving with every meeting. Of course, it was a new core group that we established. There were some people that were there previously, but this new core group is just kind of getting up to speed. Some things in place, a formal complaint process was adopted so that people that wanted to file a complaint had a method to do so. The other thing is with the GIS, putting the mapping in place, which we'll be coming back to you in the future with some proposals on changes of response times related to the areas around the county. Those are all connected now through our dispatch and through the GIS so that they're all electronically, so the reports are all consistent by each provider providing the service.
Well, that sounds like a lot of good progress.
Yes.
Last question is, I believe we are now requiring there be two cars in each service area or two cars available?
At least one car in each area.
Okay. Whereas before there wasn't that requirement?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Anything else? Are we ready for action then? I would entertain a motion.
I'll move for approval of the order for assignment of Lincoln County Ambulance Service Area ASA 4 Walport Area for the period of January 1st, 2017 through June
30,
2021.
Second. Moved and seconded. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Thank you. And now we move on to Ordinance Number 490. This is an amendment to Ordinance 487 and Lincoln County Code, Section 4.405 through 4.460, Short-Term Rental of Dwelling Units, and Declaring an Emergency. Mr. Belmont.
Commissioners, as you're well aware, the Board adopted an Ordinance Number 487, which established the requirements for licensing of short-term rental of dwelling units, our VRD, so to speak. And that goes into effect tomorrow. We've been working hard. I want to publicly thank the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, who is going to be the licensing authority. The sheriff and his staff have been tremendous to work with to put together the various forms and information we need in order to start this new licensing program. We haven't done a new licensing program in a little while, so it's been interesting to pull things together. I also like to thank our staff, Tanya and Casey especially, have been working hard at answering questions that have been coming in from folks about, you know, what do they do and how do they take care of these things. We've gotten some information out to the public now about the program here. And as we were reviewing some of the questions and getting through and some of the forms that we were putting together in here, the one thing that I saw in the code that I wanted to take care of immediately before the actual effective date of the ordinance was we had talked at length about the need of having a local contact, that the short-term dwelling units have somebody locally who can respond to complaints and concerns in a timely fashion. And we worked very hard to get that language together on the time frame for doing it, but it was a little bit unclear that the contact had to be local. And so I wanted to make sure there's no confusion at all that it's local. So this particular ordinance, which we, if you adopt it today, it would go into effect tomorrow, actually clarifies what the term contact person, what a local contact is. And basically it says that person has to be, or firm has to be physically located in Lincoln County. So that gives some clarification to that. I also wanted to delegate some authority. As you put together these kind of licensing programs, there's going to be some need to develop some rules and practices and policies consistent with the code provisions, and I wanted to have that delegated authority to the licensing authority to do that so we can establish some rules and things as we put things together. So those are the two elements that we're looking at now. I want to note just for the record and for those in the audience who might be watching, you know, again, we're starting the program tomorrow. We're already getting a lot of inquiries from applications. I think we're going to get a lot of voluntary compliance on this. I think people understand this is happening. They're going forward. I know we've had a lot of new properties have come into our treasurer tax collector because that's one of the requirements of the licensing is you have to be current, both enrolled in and current with our room tax provision. So that's been occurring, too. So we think it's going to go forward pretty smoothly, even though we're going to have a rush of these applications, obviously, at the front end, you always do. But the one thing I wanted to note is you did adopt some grandfathering provisions because there is an occupancy limit in the short-term rental ordinance, but there is an opportunity to grandfather in some pre-existing uses out there under a number of conditions which are established in the code. But there is that time frame. They have to make their application to us if they want to be grandfathered before December 31st, so they've got this window between December 1st and December 31st. I think we've been having some conversations with some of those folks already in terms of what the requirements are, how that's going to work, but I just wanted to kind of reiterate that particular open window because after December 31st, you'll be bound by the occupancy limits no matter what you've done in the past. So this is the opportunity to take advantage of that if you're one of those that qualifies. And I think that's probably all I've got to say about this at this point, unless you have any questions.
Commissioner Thompson.
People operate without a VRD permit. Talk to me about the enforcement and what's the procedure, because I've watched lots of things passed and didn't have adequate enforcement, and people just sidestepped it.
That's a good point. One of the things we've done in implementing the program here is you've established the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office as the licensing authority, and we will actually have a person working directly, actually multiple people initially, working directly on this program to both ensure that the licensing takes place and then to enforce the provisions of the code if it's not taking place out there. So we're going to have some resources available, and I guess I use the analogy of who better do you want to search out and see, you know, what's going on than the Sheriff's Department, who has a lot of experience doing these kinds of things. They know how to do investigations. They know how to determine whether a person is in compliance or not in compliance with the law. And so having this operated through the Sheriff's Office as a licensing authority is going to give us a lot of tools and resources to determine compliance with the code provisions.
So you still didn't tell me what the penalty is. That's my question.
Oh, the penalty is if you fail to have a license. There's all the enforcement mechanisms and tools that are available under the Lincoln County Code, but probably the most important thing is you fail to get a license, you can't operate a short-term rental dwelling. You can't use it for that purpose.
And then how are you going to
enforce it in court?
The sheriff will just go out and examine this? I mean, this is a challenge a lot of times.
No, it's pretty simple. This is pretty simple in the sense you're talking about. If you're using the short-term rental of the dwelling and you don't have a license, then you're in violation of the law.
Right.
You either have a license or you don't. And in terms of maybe your question.
Then what happens? That's one of the problems.
We have all the enforcement mechanisms available under the Lincoln County Code for enforcing everything in the code. And the thing you do is you go to court. We can get fines. We can get injunctions. And the most important thing is they won't be able to operate that if they don't get a license.
Okay. Let me pursue this a little farther, because I can see a situation developing where a neighbor sees a place that they believe is continuously being used or periodically being used as a rental, but there's not a lot of obvious, unless you can see it, somebody hands somebody a check, it's not a lot of obvious rental use, so they complain to the sheriff.
Yep.
Then you go through the system, and the person wants to say, no, I didn't do it, or this is not that way. This thing could drag on for a long time.
You got elements of proof, but let me just tell you this. By and large, people that do these things do very discoverable kinds of activities. They have an ad on in a magazine. They have... Are there going to be some circumstances where there's people that don't, that have no, you know... Nothing on the grid, so to speak, out there that says that kind of thing? Potentially. But that's the same kind of thing that says, we have laws that say you can't speed. Do we catch every single speeder that goes along? Yeah, I go down a side street over here, and I speed and go 90 miles an hour. Yeah, I'm violating the law. Somebody saw me, but can I get every single one?
But no. In speeding, there's a clear penalty and a clear system.
It's a clear penalty.
When you hand the ticket.
It's a clear penalty.
And it doesn't take long to happen. What I'm worried is we're going to get into a situation where these marginal cases get stuck in courts and consume a lot of our time and things that we should be working on.
Yeah, and I guess I tend to disagree with that. I think the voluntary compliance, the people have been coming forward. They know this is coming forward, and most of the people out there, like everything else,
they want to avoid the hassle.
They want to comply with the law, is what they want to do.
But that's true of it. I don't care whether it's a fishing violation or what it is, 90% or better are willing to voluntarily comply. They may make a mistake somewhere along the line, but it's that gray area that consumes all of enforcement's time.
Yep. And I'm not saying there aren't going to be some gray area ones that are out there, but by and large, that what we've seen and experienced with other entities who have had these programs in place for years doing these things is you get compliance. And we have tools. If we can show that somebody is renting and not complying, we've got great tools in which to enforce the code.
Okay, that's all.
And we're certainly in a lot better position than we were prior to this ordinance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Time will tell. We'll see. I hope you're absolutely right.
I'm hoping to. Just in terms of, there's no other questions on the code, just procedurally here, is there any request that the ordinance be read in full? Hearing none, could I have the chair again read the ordinance by title only?
Amendment to Ordinance Number 487 in Lincoln County Code, Section 4.405 through 4.460, short-term rental of dwelling units and declaring an emergency. Could I have a motion, please?
I'll move for approval of the ordinance amending Ordinance 487 and Lincoln County Code, Section 4.405 through 4.460, short-term rental of dwelling units and declaring an emergency.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, please say aye.
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 It's approved. Thank you.
I might note that the reason that we declared an emergency is so that this can be effective December 1st, which is tomorrow.
It's tomorrow. Right. We want to make sure it's clear to everybody who, as they come and make their applications, that they need to meet this requirement.
Yes. Okay, next up, name change for the portion of U.S. Highway 20 to be transferred to Lincoln County as part of the U.S. Highway 20 Pioneer Mountain Eddyville project. Mr. Belmont, and I also noticed Mr. Kenyon's here.
Yes, Commissioners, you held your hearing last week in which to consider some alternatives for a proposed name consistent with county code provisions for that portion of Highway 20 transferred to the county. I do want to note just preliminarily that we're still working with ODOT on the transfer documents. We've got some concerns with the descriptions of the areas, and we're still working through some issues to clarify that. So we don't yet have a date. I can't give you a specific date in which the actual transfer will occur. It will occur at some point. But that's forthcoming. But I think we're at the point where now you can, you've heard the alternatives, you've considered the proposal of the name Crystal Creek, and you can give us some direction with what you want to do. Let me tell you how this works once you've made that decision, though. We were a little bit concerned that we're coming up on the holiday period, and we definitely don't want to give people an address and name change right before the holiday, especially for folks that get delivery of any kind of packages or mail or anything this time of year. It seems to be heavier use of that. So under the code provisions, that actually, once you make a decision, we will issue we'll prepare an order for you to adopt. And the actual new addresses, which the between the assessor's office, public works, and the surveyor's office, they've now done the work to get those physical addresses. That will go out to people. They will actually have 90 days in which to begin using the name. That's per code. So it won't happen before the first of the year. Even if you adopt the change, if you adopt the name change before the first of the year, it won't actually go into effect for 90 days from that date.
So, okay, can I review for the benefit of folks maybe who haven't seen the other what we've just a little bit more?
Well, I wanted to mention one thing.
Okay.
That right now, since he brought it up, mm-hmm. who actually is maintaining that? I had a complaint the other day from a person that lives on the road, and of course, they thought that it was Lincoln County, and it's not yet that way. And its transition period by holding out, does that transition, where are we at on this? Because there are people out there that...
In terms of maintenance of the road, is that your question, Commissioner?
Yeah.
I just want to make sure we know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly where we're at and where we're going, when we'll get there so I can answer people.
Right. I'm Roy Kenyon, Public Works Director for Lincoln County. And like Wayne said, we are in the process of trying to finalize the documents so we can do the transfer. The transfer has not been made. We, Lincoln County, cannot spend a dime on that stretch of road until that is all signed off and sealed. So any complaints that come in still need to be referred to ODOT. ODOT still, well, they know that it's still their responsibility to maintain that stretch of road.
Okay, that's clear enough. I wanted to make sure that, and we don't have any idea how long it's going to take them to do this, to get their paperwork together and stuff.
Well, I haven't talked to Wayne yet today about it, but the last email I received from ODOT said that they would like to have our side of the documents taken care of by the 5th, which is next Monday. My assumption is that they're trying to push this through, but the document that we received the first time to have you sign was not adequate, and so we're trying to clarify that. And so ODOT is in a hurry to dump it. They don't want to have to maintain two stretches of highway, but they at this point in time are still maintaining two stretches of highway. So if there was an emergency call on the old stretch of 20 or what may be Crystal Creek Loop or whatever its name is, ODOT would be the agency that would respond to that.
Okay, so that's clarified. And then just to review where we're at on the name, ODOT required us to provide them with a provisional name for what will be the bypass, what is now the bypassed section, and we gave them Crystal Creek Loop. We held the public hearing last week. I believe, unless I'm not aware of more, we received two emails total suggesting alternative names, and one of the folks who submitted the emails, the Samsons, came last week and proposed that we consider Morris X. Smith Loop as an alternative to Crystal Creek Loop. So I guess I'll throw it open to the board whether there's an interest in considering an alternative name or sticking with Crystal Creek Loop.
Well, I mentioned last week that I had one person that lives on there says he likes the name, that Crystal Creek Loop. I appreciate what Samson's had to say, Morris X. Smith, I think it was, but I've asked people, nobody's ever heard anything about these people before, and traditionally, when you name a building, it's usually somebody that has some general name recognition in the area. There may be more people out there, because I don't
Yes, if you grew up in the Chitwood, Eddyville area, you'd be very familiar with Morse X Smith, but outside of that community, probably not.
Right. And it is a road in the area. So, at least my opinion is Crystal Creek Loop has a little better ring than Morris X. Smith. It's not that I have anything against him. It sounds like he did a lot of great things from what the Samsons had to say. But it seems like if you're going to name something, I'd like to have a little broader context of that name and the rest of the community.
I would agree.
So would I. You know, you're never going to find a name that will please everybody, but I think, I'm with you, gentlemen. I would be just as happy sticking with Crystal Creek Loop. So,
can I get a motion to that effect, yes, and then directing staff to prepare a necessary order to adopt that name?
So I'll move to proceed with name change for the portion of U.S. Highway 20 to be transferred to Lincoln County as part of U.S. Highway 20 Pioneer Mountain Eddyville Project.
And the motion should clarify what the new name is, I would think.
Gosh, I've already forgotten. Yeah. What did you say? Propose that we change the name to Crystal Creek Loop.
Okay, second.
Okay, we've got a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. All right.
We'll prepare the final order and bring that forward in a future meeting.
Minor.
Okay. Discussion and information. Purchase of the property for Health and Human Services Respite Housing on Northwest Cottage Street in Newport. We had a presentation on this last week and agreed, I think the board consensus was to move it forward. And so what have we got now today? Mr. Belmont and also Cheryl O'Connell, HHS Director, is here.
So again, if you have any questions on the specific crisis respite services or housing that's going to be provided there, you can provide Director Connell can answer those, but I've just prepared a memorandum which outlines the terms of the agreement that we're moving forward with, specifically the purchase price, $315,000, of which $5,000 in earnest money has already been provided. And I just wanted to note, make sure it's clear for the record, that this is money coming from Health and Human Services funding and not from the County General Fund for this particular purchase. And that we had a number of due diligence conditions in there that we needed to exercise, in which we looked at the title, the condition of the building, we did environmental inspection. So I identified those in the memorandum, and if anybody would like to look at the specifics, we did hire two professional firms to conduct inspections for us, and their findings were nothing that they found causes us any concerns. Therefore, we recommend that those contingencies be met at this time. So the next steps we need to do here, we've also, of course, confirmed the zoning with the City of Newport Planning Department, too, for this particular use. So what we're looking at here is what we'd like to do is Director Connell's going to be meeting with the representative for the property owners today, I think, at 11:30, and we'd like to be able to release our conditions. That's one of the part of the sales agreement, is to release those conditions and move forward. And then what we would do next is come back to you with a specific order authorizing the purchase of the property at our December 7th meeting, and that will allow us to complete the necessary transactions, delegate authority to myself, actually, to deal with the closing elements, the escrow instructions, all the conveyance documents, make sure that's all together, prorations and any related activities.
Right. Traditionally, a commissioner would be signing off on property documents, but just because of various business commitments, I believe all three of us will be out of town on that date, so we would designate you the authority to do that, yeah, acting as our representative.
And the main action you take is, again, on the 7th, is to authorize the purchase.
Right. So are we comfortable with moving forward? Are there any questions either for Council Belmont or Director Connell?
And maybe just note, and I see that, that Steve Card's here, I did also provide, and I apologize for the quality, maybe we can make one copy in color. It looks a little bit better in color, where the subject property is in relation to some other landmark properties there. So if you wanted to know specifically where it is, that's identified in that map.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I might note that I received one email after the public meeting that was held, and I asked Director Connell to respond to it. I thought she did a very thorough job. I thought she addressed the issues that were raised. So really, I've only heard one comment that questioned this decision. So I think that speaks well as far as the general support.
Okay. So I'm hearing a consensus that we'll move this forward for action next week then, correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. Next up, agreement between the State of Oregon through its Department of Revenue and Lincoln County authorizing the Department of Revenue to collect taxes related to marijuana sales on behalf of the county and distribute the proceeds to the county for a fee to be calculated. Presented by Jerry Herbage. Good morning, sir.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'm Jerry Herbage for the record, and what we're really talking about today is the draft agreement that you talked about, but for purposes of really discussing it and not adopting it today. Wayne and I wanted to go over that with you and point out some salient points, but let's give a little background to that. You recall that ORS 475B345 was adopted in 2015 to allow local jurisdictions, that is counties and cities, to impose a local tax on, and we're talking about recreational marijuana, not medical marijuana. And also what was approved later, and it relates to what we're talking about today, the 2016 legislature clarified that local governments may contract with the Oregon Department of Revenue to collect, enforce, administer, and distribute locally imposed marijuana taxes. So that was House Bill 4014, Section 32. That's kind of what we're talking about today. In regards to the tax, we must remember that the retailer, and this gets imposed, can retain up to 2% of the tax to cover their expenses. And remember that the state is imposing a 17% tax. Local jurisdictions were allowed to impose up to a 3% tax. One of the reasons why this agreement exists is because it's very convenient for the state to do both at the same time. They're going to be collecting their tax. It should be cost efficient to also collect the tax for the local jurisdictions. One of the reasons why we're discussing this today, of course, is that this board approved the ordinance imposing the tax on the recreational sale of marijuana items. And a copy of what you approved. And to those who are in this room, and the board knows this, this is only for the unincorporated area of Lincoln County, that Lincoln County imposed a tax of 3% on the retail sale price of marijuana items, which is a term of art, but it's fairly broadly construed by the statutes. But on the sale of recreational marijuana items, and so that was sent to the voters. The voters approved that on November 8th. And so part of the process, of course, is for the clerk to certify the results and so on. And that happened apparently this week. We received a confirmation on Monday, I think, in this office that it had passed, and we got the certified results. So let's talk about the draft itself. We had received some emails from Rob Bavette, the counsel for AOC, as this was being developed. So on September 6th, he let us know that various the League of Oregon Cities and AOC were in this process of developing this draft. And what Rob Bavette said is, after some meetings with DOR, the crew from LOC and I then crafted a draft IGA. So that's the genesis of this agreement. He put a disclaimer on the email from September 6th. He said, we did not negotiate the draft IGA on behalf of any particular city or county. He said, of any city or county. It's an effort to attempt to create a standard template. Every city or county with a local marijuana tax is free to collect their own tax or negotiate their own IGA with DOR outside of the process. DOR, of course, would prefer to have as many cities and counties use the standard template, but nothing requires that outcome. So I want you to be aware of that. We have a subsequent email from Rob. These things are important to you, I think. Let's go over those. He said, here are some highlights of the IGA template. DOR can start administering the local tax beginning January 1, 2017. He said, counties must sign an agreement by January 15, 2017 and provide DOR with a copy of their ordinance for administration to begin the first quarter of 2017. Said payments to local governments will be made quarterly, and for administration purposes, DOR will withhold its 4%, that's what they came up with, 4% of the total local tax revenues to pay for the state's costs. Actual costs will be assessed and trued up yearly using three different fees to calculate each local government's share of the costs. And then he gives some contact information if the county is interested in this. So I've looked at the agreement itself, and that's what's in my hand here. Let me just make a few comments about it, and then I'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have. What struck me about the agreement is, one is the general administration. This is, I think you have a copy in your materials. This is on page 2 in section 2. To me, the responsibility of the Department of Revenue, when it says the department means the Department of Revenue, is very broad. They have pretty much the complete responsibility to administer it with a little bit of contact with the county in various situations where needed. But it says the department shall be responsible for all aspects of local tax administration, including and but not limited to, you know, adopting administrative rules, auditing returns, assessing deficiencies, collecting the local tax, penalties and interest, and then goes on to, you know, include handling appeals to the Oregon Tax Court, issuing warrants for collection of unpaid tax. Pretty broad there in terms of, I mean, I think generally they're going to occupy that area of the general administration. The next paragraph indicates their level of service is supposed to be comparable. There's some exceptions to what they would administer in their own taxes, because remember, they're collecting their 17%. This is done on a quarterly basis, as I mentioned before in Section 4. So the way it works is the payment would come out, I think, 60 days after the quarterly, after the quarter. And I told you that 4% would be withheld, but let's go over this concept. I think that risk management, or how the risk of, you know, whether this comes out right or not, is an issue. And the way the agreement was drafted is that there is a true up. So it is possible that the administrative expenses could be less than that 4%, but also it could be more than. And so this is drafted in such a way that the state isn't going to be holding something, but it gets trued up on both sides. There's three fees. I'd referenced that before. It's ABC. It's sort of funny. If you look at page 3, the A is administrative service fee, B is the business fee, which is the main fee, the business fee, and then there's a core systems replacement fee. So those are described, but ABC, those three fees, are what's supposed to make up the 4%, although it could be more or less. So there's provisions for withholding fees, rebates, and so on. It's always important that there be reports, so there's going to be quarterly reports. That's Section 8 on page 5, Department annual reports. And what I found interesting about the annual reports, it says in the middle there, The department shall make recommendations concerning changes to local tax ordinances, procedures, policies, local tax administration related matters as the department deems necessary and appropriate. So they may give some recommendations about your local situation. Our obligation would be to keep them up to date with who the local taxpayers are. That's in paragraph 10. Obviously, requirements for records and stuff. We need to submit with this agreement our ordinance. There's a section on confidentiality. I'm going to follow up on some of the issues with Rob when we're done, because the confidentiality section seems kind of funny, as it addresses every kind of tax in the world except for this tax, so I'm not quite sure how that works. But anyway, the term, it looks like it's basically can be terminated with 90 days written notice.
Either party.
Yeah, either party. Good point. We'll need to, if we approve of this later, we'll need to figure out who will be the county contact, right? So notices is in section 18 on page 8, and they list where notices go for the state. But if we go ahead with this, you'll need to figure out who in the county sort of have the responsibility for communication and that sort of thing. There'll be a few more responsibilities, but generally the state is saddled with the obligation of making sure that the taxes happen. You don't have it in your materials, but there's a secrecy clause thing that needs to be signed by whoever will be handling the information. To me, and Wayne maybe could comment on this, it's a little bit analogous to the transient lodging tax, right? You get certain confidential information on that, and so there would be certain confidential information from any business that would be subject to this tax, and it's very important that information be properly handled, not improperly disclosed, and there are penalties if you don't. So whoever's handling the county side of the, the reports and the, so on, would need to file, sign this agreement and send it in. So we're not asking that the board approve this today. We wanted to give you some background. I gave you the initial information because actually the county could, if it wanted to, just handle this internally without going through the state. I think that there would be more advantages of going with the state. There are also, under the county circumstance, county situation here, certain things that we need to look at before we bring it back to you. So we don't want to get into the particulars of the application of this, but rather the global part. That's what we're doing today.
Okay. Any appreciate the due diligence. Any questions or comments from the board at this point?
Well, I don't know if this. I have a comment. I get a lot of questions about how much revenue is this going to raise, and for general purposes, I think it's obviously we're talking about 3% on sales within the unincorporated area of the county.
That's correct.
But on top of that, the county will get, correct me if I'm wrong, 10% of the revenue from retail marijuana sales within the county, regardless of the location, under Measure 91, whatever, I forget what it was.
Jerry, do you remember that? I don't remember the percentage.
Well, I think it's a portion of it, yes. I believe it's 10%. So my point is, of all the retail marijuana sales in the county, we'll get roughly 4.7%. We get 1.7 of 17 is collected by the state, and we'll get 3% on the sales in the unincorporated area of the county. So if you look at $1 million in sales, that's $4,700. So that's not a lot of money.
Right. I think a lot of people, they see headlines about the state collecting tens of millions of dollars in marijuana taxes, and they think it's going to be a local pot of gold, and it's not. As you explained there, we were talking about an initial state 25% tax, and that's collected statewide. But here in Lincoln County, unless we see significant changes in the business, it doesn't look like a significant revenue source.
Well, it's not a significant revenue. It's a loser.
Right.
I don't like to support losers.
Right.
I mean, it's just not my habit.
The voters and the legislature didn't give us a choice on that, though.
But my point is we're going to spend a bunch of money on enforcement out there protecting the marijuana growers. We're going to have other kinds of enforcement problems, and we're expected to do it out of our already existing funds. Excuse me, but I think there's a problem here.
No, that's exactly my point. This is not going to be a pot of gold for the county.
And there's an impression that it is.
And the costs relative to it are going to be far greater.
Mr. Chair, can I make one comment?
Sure, please go ahead.
Thank you. So I have a synopsis of what Commissioner Hunt was talking about. I think it was Measure 91 provides for distribution of revenue after costs. This is from the state side of the tax, and I'm not quite sure exactly all the nuances of this, so I'd need to follow up a little bit. But it's 40% to common school fund, 20% to mental health, alcoholism, and drug services, 15% to state police, 10% to cities for enforcement of the measure, and then 10% to counties for enforcement of the measure, and then 5% to Oregon Health Authority for alcohol and drug abuse prevention. But the way this was lobbied for and so on, one could argue that the counties got the short end of the stick on that.
So I'm going to ask you a question. We have a lot of responsibility for a lot of different types of crimes in the county. And if it turns out that we only get $5,000
per million,
or how? Let's hope that. So let's say maybe we get. You have any feel for what there might be in total millions?
I think millions is as good as any figure when you consider that the 3%, which is the bulk of the 4.7, is only on unincorporated area sales, and we have one or possibly two locations at this time.
So anyway, we're looking at.
So we're really talking about probably 2% versus 4.7 on average.
So we're looking at this. I'm going to have a problem if we're going to go out and have to do a bunch of law enforcement. And I'm going to wait and see the statistics in these areas. If we let other crimes go that we're already dealing with, it's going to be an interesting challenge of how we deal with that. And Sheriff Leonard, would you like to make any comments on this? Because you're going to be the one that's going to be stuck in this mess.
Well, we are definitely entering a unique world here and moving forward to the unknown, really. We don't know, how much revenue. Obviously, it's not going to be enough to add personnel to address any issues that do come up. We're kind of looking to the metro area on some aspects. They've already had some issues with robbery of the dispensaries because it's a cash-only society, because federal government still looks at it as illegal and the banks can't process it, so it's cash-only. Being a cash-only society, are they actually going to report all the revenue that they're actually receiving? And that's not even something we enforce, but that's something else that we're probably only getting a fraction of what's even being taken in, too. I guess it is going to be difficult. So far, we haven't really seen much of an impact, but it's been fairly new. I think it's going to take a few years before we actually see the true impact, and I don't know what it's going to be. I really don't.
That's a reasonable answer.
Yeah. Probably as accurate as you can hope for in present time.
Yeah. I hear and read some discussions that the fact that California approved recreational may be at this month's election, may finally be the tipping point to push Congress into dealing with giving states where it is legal, either recreationally, medicinally, or both, give something to address the cash-only issue. And I would think that in itself would be a crime prevention, a crime reduction measure. But who knows, with a new president and a new Congress, how much receptivity there might be to that.
Yeah, you may see the winds going in the opposite direction under the new presidential.
Yeah. I guess it's not going to reduce crime.
No.
I'm just not sure how big of impact it's going to be.
Right.
And we're not gaining any more personnel to help address it. So it's going to be some impact on us.
We're not going to get enough money to be able to add personnel.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. So I guess I'm hearing a sense that you know, will the consensus is staff will continue to evaluate and report back to us, but my initial thought is, especially given the amount of revenue involved, you know, that for us to consider setting up our own collection mechanism, it's just adding one more expense we don't need.
And that's the direction actually we're looking for today, is we want to make sure you want us to continue down this road.
Please proceed.
Okay, good.
Yes. And correct, Commissioner Thompson?
No, it's fine.
Yeah. That, okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Of the two choices, it's the lesser.
Yeah. Right. All righty. We move on to commissioner reports. Well, I'll start off. Talk about venturing into the unknown. Our CCO board meeting yesterday in Corvallis, lots of interesting discussion and really no answers in terms of with the change in administration, and talk about big changes or even repeal of the Affordable Care Act, what kind of impact that's going to have in Oregon and the Medicaid expansion. You know, we went from, 16% of the Lincoln County population prior to Medicaid expansion was uninsured. Now we're down to 4%, and that has, is that going to be reversed? That they say that folks in Congress are realizing that if there is going to be a repeal, they've got to have something in place that's something like 20 million people nationwide, that... whether it's an incentive to just buy private insurance, but there's going to have to be some provision for those folks, at least I'll personally say I hope there is. And then another interesting conversation, again, we don't know the outcomes, is future direction of mental health services. And the State Health Authority has a work group, and county people are participating in that with a lot of other stakeholders, and there's really some concern that there might be a move to shift a significant part of mental health services and even potentially the legal role as the local mental health authority from the counties to the CCOs, yet potentially leave us still with some legal obligations. So that's a big question mark as well, and I don't think we'll see that settled until sometime next year during the legislative session. So, anything to report, gentlemen?
I'll just report that continuing the effort to develop a maritime workforce sector, I'll be at the Business Summit in Portland. I believe my fellow commissioners also will be there, but we'll have a session on the maritime workforce sector.
Good.
And continue to work to develop sector strategies to provide training and jobs for people locally and keep them locally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was fortunate enough to go over to the Oregon State game.
And you're a Beaver, so...
Well, I'm a Beaver, but I like to see any team with Oregon in the name win. In this case, I couldn't lose. But it was a good game. But as I'm sitting in with all the officials, and I was concerned that the hot subject in Salem was the discussion about MSC here at, being built in the tsunami zone at the Hatfield Marine Science Center. And I'm like, wait a minute. Local people, I'm not hearing a lot about it. We are the ones that are the most impacted, and, you know, you get used to living with your own danger, whether it's in a hurricane in Florida or wherever it is, and we're looking to try to figure out how to minimize the impact so we can still function and be in these zones. And you get over there, and there, I mean, it was a hot subject over there. So I'm going to try to figure out a response, because it's bothering me a lot that the people that are living in the zone where this could be, and we're concerned. We're trying to get engineering. We're trying to build things so that they can minimize impacts. And over there, they're talking about, well, we just need to move on a hill. If that's the policy, then the first thing we should do is go to San Francisco and tell them to get off that peninsula. And I don't see anybody doing that. I don't see anybody in Florida. They've spent $400 million on hurricanes in the last few years. I don't see anybody saying, don't come to Florida, you can't live in Florida. But if it's economic development for the coast, there's a different attitude coming out of Corvallis than I'm seeing with local people. So it's going to be a challenge, and I'm going to get a chance to try to sort this out and figure out how a proper response. Okay. I was really upset when I heard that Ed Ray was taking a lot of flack, because in my mind he's been a tremendous asset to Oregon State University. And so that's my reaction. It was way bigger, big game for me to watch, mm-hmm. and great to see the Beavers win, but there was a lot of other issues that came up there that I'm wrestling with besides playing a game.
Good information.
That's good to know. Okay, this is the time we ask for constituent input. Hearing none, we are going to be recessing into executive session.
Actually, we don't need that
today. Oh, we don't need it today. Okay. And then we will meet again next Wednesday, December 7th, 9:30, here at the courthouse.